welcome to The Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, again, we talk about the U.S.-Cuba relations and the Cuban Five. And here's Peter to introduce today's guests.
Ricardo Alarcón has been Cuba's permanent representative to the United Nations for nearly 30 years and has served since 1993 as president of the National Assembly of the People's Power, the legislative parliament of the Republic of Cuba. The parliament has over 600 members elected from single-member electoral districts throughout Cuba. Also with us is Martin Garbus. He is one of the country's leading trial attorneys and is representing the Cuban Five here in the United States. Also with us today is Gloria Larriva. As a labor, community, and social activist, she is coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five and has worked for decades in hostilities towards Cuba. So, Ricardo, we'll start with you. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. So good to hear your voice. We want to start right out, generally speaking. What is the most misunderstood ideas about Cuba in the United States today?
Well, there are many, many things that are really misunderstood out there. I think that the most important thing, perhaps, is that you have here a country with a people that has been striving for a long time to build up an independent society. It has been a long, long history of struggling for that, and that is also one of your closest neighbors, and with a lot of cultural and people-to-people links that should deserve for a better official relationship. And many Americans simply do not know that because they are not permitted to visit Cuba and to see for themselves what's going on around here.
It seems that you have a General Assembly of 600 people. It sounds very democratic. What are some of the changes that are moving forward in Cuba today that we often do not hear about in the United States?
Well, we are involved since the last 4 or 5 years in a rather complex process of transforming our economy, adjusting it to the new realities of the world. For many years, the Cuba's economy was very closely linked to what was the Soviet Union and its allies in Eastern Europe, and that had obviously disappeared. And we had to face that reality together with a constant incremental process of the so-called U.S. embargo against Cuba that has continued since Eisenhower years, even now, with President Obama, notwithstanding the softer language, more sophisticated diplomacy, but the fact is that this administration has been more keen, even the President Bush, in implementing the financial aspects of the embargo, of punishing people that deal with Cuba and trying to damage us further. The other aspect of the situation that Americans may not be fully aware of is that we are doing that in a new era in Latin America, and we have many, many friends. As a matter of fact, everybody else in the hemisphere except the U.S. And we, with the help, the cooperation with the countries such as Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, and Mexico, and the Caribbean, we are trying to adjust what we still consider to be the best alternative, what we call socialism, meaning by that a society based on human solidarity, on the achievement of justice for everybody, while at the same time being an underdeveloped country, a tropical island, which, for example, we just suffered a terrible blow by this hurricane that also, imagine what happened in this coast of the U.S. when it was just a tropical storm. Compare that. Imagine what happened in eastern Cuba when that storm was a number 3 hurricane with full force that practically destroyed the second city of Cuba, Santiago de Cuba. We have to face all those realities also, and to try to do that in our own way, according to our own customs and traditions, in what we call participatory democracy, having everybody involved in the discussions and the efforts to change the economy, to improve our society, to have what we hope to be a better brand of our own socialist project.
Cuba is a socialist state, and in that regard, people have full health care, free public education, and so talk about what that means. One thing that's happening here in the United States today is we call it Black Friday. In other words, it's the biggest shopping day of the year. Now, in Cuba, children grow up and they never see an advertisement. And we think that that's a main huge cultural difference. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I remember I come from the upper middle class in Cuba, and I remember the days where Havana was a pale imitation of New York. We also have my class had the same values and for us celebration of Christmas or any day that is supposed to be to have a spiritual meaning was mostly a matter of going around and shopping but that was not the reality for every Cuban. Was a minor group of privileged people, and I believe really that not in spite of the propaganda and the marketing, many Americans are not really enjoying life and having the possibilities of access to the goods that are projected and so present in the media, like as it is in Europe. You are probably celebrating going shopping while in Spain, in Italy, in other places, they are striking. Their people are striking because they have they're going through very difficult times, very difficult moments due to something very fundamental. What many are beginning to realize, this notion of a brand of capitalism, that so-called neoliberalism, that is based in the expansion of individual greed at the expense of the majorities, the 1% versus the 99%. In our country, an underdeveloped country, subjected to the longest economic embargo in history, of course we have a lot of limitations, but we make a choice. Let's assure for everybody the fundamentals: healthcare, education, possibilities of cultural life and sports, and a very important thing, social security. To have the possibility of being supported by society if you are sick or if you are old, if you cannot produce anymore, and so on. This notion is more and more absent from the model that has been imposed throughout the world in the last years. By the way, the model that is so much questioned throughout South America, giving a road to what is going on now in Venezuela, from Venezuela to Brazil, to Argentina, to everywhere, you have masses of people that have forced the previous governments out and are trying to develop their own brand of social justice and independence. We're doing the same, and modestly, we do not have material resources to do otherwise, but modestly also trying to improve the material conditions of everybody, not just a group, of every member of the society.
That's the voice of Ricardo Alarcón, president of the National Assembly in Cuba. This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show, Pacifica Radio. This morning is a show focusing all on U.S.-Cuba relations in the Cuban Five. We're going to be joined momentarily here by attorney Martin Garbus, attorney for the Cuban Five. But right now we're going to turn our attention to Gloria LaRiva, coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. So we're going to hear a little bit about that. But also, just to note, Cuba's made the freeing of the Cuban Five a really important issue between Cuba and U.S. relations. Maybe you can talk a little bit about why that is and just give a little background of coming up to that issue.
Well, I think that what's not known in the United States, although the American people had the experience of a terrorist attack in 9/11, is that the Cuban people have suffered terrorist attacks for 50 years since the dawn of the revolution in 1959. And with the impending collapse of the Soviet Union, there was an increase in terrorism based out of Miami groups in southern Florida, financed by the CIA. These groups receive arms and training from the U.S. And in the early 1990s, there were a group of men, some of who are now known as the Cuban Five, who were in Miami monitoring the plots of the terrorists in Miami in order to thwart their plans. And to make a very long story short, instead of arresting the terrorists in Miami who were carrying out attacks on Cuba, the FBI arrested the Cuban Five in September of 1998. They've been in prison ever since in the United States. And they were placed in solitary confinement for 17 months. Finally, their trial was held in the one city where they could never have any justice or any hope of justice. But they were convicted unjustly in 2001. After their first stage of appeals, the 11th Circuit Court in Atlanta ruled that they, in fact, shouldn't have been tried in Miami, and their convictions were overturned. But the Bush administration appealed that victory of the Five, and it was the trial was confirmed by the full bank en banc panel of the court. We've been in a struggle ever since then, and Martin Garbus, as you said, he joined a team this year of the Cuban Five, and there is a very significant habeas corpus appeals currently underway in which Mr. Garbus will explain that today. But I think that their case, while unknown for many years, has reached a much wider audience around the world, and certainly I think in the United States there's been progress, although not enough, because we believe in the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five and many others involved in this, that once the American people learn of their cause, that they peacefully, without any weapons, the Cuban Five were saving lives, stopping terrorism, the people will demand their freedom, and that's what it will take. In addition to the legal struggle, the popular movement to demand that these men should never have had a day in prison, but they must be freed immediately. And there's much that people can do to help in that cause.
We'll turn now to Martin Garbus, as the attorney for the Cuban Five. Martin, one of the things that has emerged now is that we're aware that the U.S. government was paying members of the Miami media to do insightful publications during the trial. And so, it really poisoned the atmosphere there. Can you talk about the legal case now and the habeas corpus appeal for Geraldo Hernandez?
Sure. The amount of money that the American government was pouring into the case in order to persuade and intimidate the jurors is astonishing. I've been practicing law for a good period of time. I've never seen anything like it. There's no reported case like it. Tens of millions of dollars from 1996 to 2001 were poured into the Miami area, and the money went both to well-known newspapers, the Miami Herald and Nuevo Herald, to the writers for those newspapers. It also went into the radio talk shows and the radio shows themselves and the television shows. And what happened was people were paid to do this writing, and the people who were paid did not disclose that they were on the government payroll. They were just, if the reader read it, the reader would think it's an independent journalist or an independent thinker who was just expressing his own views rather than the fact that he was expressing the government's views. the people who were doing this kind of work basically fit into two categories. Those people who previously worked for a place like the Miami Herald, or those people who were subsequently hired to work for the Miami Herald because of government monies. The people who were hired to do this writing for that five-year period all came from the same political background. They were former Bay of Pigs people. They were people who were jailed in Cuba for anti-government activities. They were people who had been jailed in the United States for having committed violence against the Cubans in Miami. And they were people with CIA connections. So what you had the American government doing, and it's absolutely remarkable, is hiring people who are not journalists primarily, some of them not journalists at all, to write articles. Now, the articles coming out under their name. In fact, did these people write these articles, or were they just turned out of some cookie-cutter machine, some propaganda machine? And it seems that they were just turned out by some cookie-cutter machine. The names of the people who wrote these articles are names like Orlando Bosch. They're people who have a long history of anti-Castro history. Now, we're not talking about a criminal case where you have a witness who comes up and recants his testimony, or you have forensic evidence that is this or that. You're talking here about a massive, massive government program from 1996 to 2001 to get a conviction. And the question is, why does so much money go into this? Miami, of course, as we all know, was a pivot for the election for 2000, and has been the pivot for so many other elections, and could have been the pivot for this particular election. This prosecution has started under Clinton, and it is finished under Bush. Everybody had a great stake in pacifying and satisfying the right-wing community, Cuban community. And the right-wing Cuban community desperately wanted the conviction of these men. The shootdown is 1996. It's not until many years later that any of these defendants are charged with the murder. The government knew where these defendants were in 1996, 1997, and thereafter. They're never arrested. They're never bothered. But afterwards, as the election approaches, there's a pressing need to give the right-wing community some solace because of the shootdown. And the solace is to arrest and convict these people, for which many of them, Gerardo, for example, is serving a double life sentence. So I think that when I articulate it, when I outline it, and I talk about tens of millions of dollars involving hundreds of people over a 4 or 5 year period, it sounds like a fantasy. And when I started to see it, and I started to see the results of the work that people like Gloria and others had done for years, pulling together the information, it was astonishing. If you understand the politics and understand that the Cold War is still being fought in the Florida Straits, then you can see what was done. The amount of money that was available in Miami for the right wing, whether it came through Radio Martí or groups like the National Endowment for Democracy, was stunning. Radio Martí is $37 million a year. It was a honeypot for the right-wing Cubans to put maximum pressure on the government to get these convictions. You know, I'd have to go through it in more detail. We're filing papers today to set aside that conviction, and we are before a Florida judge who had been the judge who had successfully led the conviction. So she has a predisposition to keeping the conviction alive. We'll see what happens.
So Geraldo Hernandez was convicted of affiliation with a murder because the plane was shot down. Gloria, could you give us a little background on that? And then let's go to Ricardo after that and ask him about the where that plane was.
Yes. In the mid-1990s, an organization called Brothers to the Rescue, which openly had a mission of helping Cuban rafters in the Florida Straits. But the head of that group, Jose Basulto, has a long terrorist history, and he actually was involved in planning future terrorist attacks inside Cuba. This was known because of people who were infiltrated in that group among the Cuban Five. In the mid-1990s, in the mid-1995, he began a series of invasions into Cuban airspace, directly buzzing Havana buildings with planes of his pilots. And in January 1996, he boasted on Miami television that he would fly into Cuba with his pilots. Cuba warned the U.S. that if this continued, they would take direct action to protect their people and their sovereignty. And very interestingly, Bill Richardson, an official in the Clinton administration, traveled to Cuba twice, weeks before the shootdown, because Cuba did shoot the planes down. He traveled to Cuba and gave the Cuban leadership assurances that Clinton would not allow the planes to take off because Cuba had warned, stop these flights, stop these attacks on our island. But on February 24th, 1996, an important date to remember, the planes did invade. Three planes, six pilots invaded Cuban airspace, and two of them were shot down. Now, the reason why it relates to the five in a very false way is that the Miami right-wing community and the U.S. government wanted blood vengeance against Cuba for what was really an act of a defense of their island. And when the five were arrested 2.5 years later, there was an immediate cry in the Miami media, a hysteria. Really, the hysteria lasted from the day of the shootdown. And 7 months after their arrest, Gerardo Hernandez, who is serving double life in Victorville Prison in Southern California, was indicted on a charge of murder conspiracy. Now, three of the five were also charged with espionage conspiracy. We must know that the history of U.S. prosecution uses conspiracy when there is not even a crime committed. You can charge someone with a conspiracy and give them heavy, long sentences, even if a crime was never committed, and that's what took place. He was charged, Gerardo was charged, with having plotted with Cuba. Here he is in Miami, helping protect the Cuban population from terrorism. He was charged with plotting with Cuba to shoot the planes down in international waters because that was a dispute. Cuba had evidence that the planes were shot down in Cuban waters. The U.S. claimed they were shot down in international waters. But the point is, he had nothing to do with the shootdown. It was a sovereign act of Cuba, but Gerardo had nothing to do with it. And yet, in the Miami community, the Miami atmosphere of hysteria against anyone defending Cuba, he was convicted. And that's why, until we free him, the sentence says that he will remain in prison for the rest of his life. And he never harmed anyone. And this is a very important issue for the people to know.
Ricardo Alacon, the Brothers of the Rescue plane, Cuba has maintained and provided evidence that they were inside Cuban airspace. Is that correct?
Yes, that was what we found through our radars. And as a matter of fact, the American side said that at the moment, at the instant where they were shot down, two of them had been on the other side, and we're talking about the seconds in flying, but that was their allegation. And that the leader of the group was well inside Cuba. They even recognized that. But that's not the fundamental issue, because the fundamental issue is that Gerardo Hernandez didn't have anything at all to do with that. In any case, you were talking about what the authorities decided and what our Air Force did. But Gerardo is not a member of the Air Force, was not involved in this action at all. By the way, that is why the Attorney General, the prosecutors themselves, in May 2001, just before the verdict, recognized that in light of the evidence presented at trial, quoting them, it is impossible to prove that accusation. Gerardo Hernandez is condemned to two life terms for something that he was not accused at the time of the verdict because the prosecutors had recognized their failure to prove that. That's something, one of the many elements of this trial that was not known by many in the U.S. outside of Miami. Because you have this very strange role of the media. The local media was paid by the government to create an atmosphere making it impossible to have a fair trial. But outside of Miami, the media kept silent, absolutely silent, throughout the process, and even now, in order to make it impossible for people to know the truth and to express their solidarity with those innocent being tried down there in Miami.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff here with Peter Phillips. Today we're talking all about U.S.-Cuba relations and the Cuban Five. That was the voice of Ricardo Alarcón, president of the National Assembly in Cuba. We're also joined by attorney Martin Garbus for the Cuban Five and Gloria LaRiva, coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. After a short musical break, we'll be back with all of our guests and we'll continue our discussion. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Morning Mix, Pacifica Radio. We're going to continue our discussion about Cuba relations and the Cuban Five with today's guests. Ricardo Alarcón, President of the National Assembly in Cuba, Martin Garbus, attorney for the Cuban Five, and Gloria LaRiva, coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. Peter?
Let me just add one thing to what President Alarcón said.
This is Martin.
It's impossible, I think, for the listener to understand what a preposterous prosecution this was. People are charged with committing murder who were in Miami at the time of a shootdown over Cuba. They have no connection to the events that went on before or during that shootdown. They were people who were arrested later on, years later, purely to satisfy a political purpose. Unless you understand the politics of Miami, the power of the right wing, the fighting of the Cold War in Florida and Miami, and the prize that the Miami vote is for the Democratic and Republican parties, you really can't even imagine what happened there. It seems like a fantasy to describe it in the way that I just described it. Similarly, it sounds like a fantasy to talk about tens of millions of dollars coming in each year to make sure that this prosecution is successful. It's bizarre. I've been practicing law a good time. Nothing like it has ever happened before in the United States anywhere.
And I'd like to bring up one mention of the dozens of articles that appeared right after the shootdown, all the way through the arrest and trial of the five, that made it impossible for any jury composed of the people of Miami to have any sense of neutrality or to grant the five a fair trial. This is information that was never known during trial of these paid journalists. One of them was Luis Aguilar León, a paid agent, really, for the U.S. government. And 3 days after the shootdown by Cuba of the planes, which Gerardo, again, was falsely charged with years later, on February 27, 1996, in El Nuevo Herald, the most prominent Spanish newspaper in the U.S., he said, "One wishes for the power to send three well-armed fighter jets to fly over Varadero Beach, shooting, to delight in the image of a stampeding bunch of lewd tourists, the kind who believe that in Cuba everything is for sale, jumping over fences and fleeing across the sand." In other words, here is a journalist prominent in Miami proposing terrorism, shooting people down on a beach in Cuba after the plane shootdown. This is a hysteria that was created by a man who was on the government payroll for 20 years. And he was a professor also at Georgetown University. But Luis Aguilar León, it was not known to the trial attorneys. And yet they fought several times during the trial from 2000 to 2001 to have the trial of the Cuban Five moved out of Miami to a more neutral place, even 25 miles north in Fort Lauderdale, and the judge refused several times. This is part of what Mr. Garbus and the other attorneys are arguing for, a new trial, for the immediate freedom of the five, for justice, basically, for them to be able to be free and go home to their families.
Ricardo Alarcón, over the 50 years or more now, the U.S. has been actively engaged in covert operations against Cuba in a variety of ways, including attempted assassinations and assassinations, bombings, and a variety of issues. One of the points right now, relative to the Cuban Five that the U.S. has been making, is that Alan Gross, who was arrested there in Cuba for illegal activities against the country, they're asking for his release. Can you tell us about that case a little bit, and how might he be one to be traded someday for the Cuban Five?
Well, regarding Mr. Gross, let me tell you this. On Friday, November the 16th, 2012, Mr. Gross and his wife had presented a complaint, filed a complaint, to the U.S. District Court of Colombia, complaining against whom? The United States of America and Development Alternatives Incorporated, the company for which he was working. In this complaint, Mr. Gross himself recognized several times, let me quote him, "It made abundantly clear that we are all playing with fire by agreeing to participate in the Cuban project, and that we need to be extremely careful and quiet about such activities and to exercise discretion over it." Again, this is, I'm quoting him again, "This is very risky business in no uncertain terms." In no uncertain terms, this is very risky business. Those are quotations from his reports that were sent to the AID, the official agency of the U.S. that promotes these subversive campaigns. In its motion, Mr. Gross, from November the 16th this year, he quoted, rightly so, the Hans-Burton Act and all the so-called Cuban program that it is developed by the United States government. The United States government has for more than a year refused to recognize that this gentleman was a paid agent sent by the U.S. government as part of a subversive operation. We have been telling them that they have a responsibility, and we are prepared to sit down with the U.S. and try to find a humanitarian solution for Mr. Gross' case. But it has to be reciprocal. You cannot be concerned just with one family. I think that Mr. Gross should be free, join his family and so on, as everybody should, because after all, the main responsibles, the people responsible for that, are hiding behind him and trying to confuse American public opinion by talking about a man that was doing some humanitarian work on his own. That was not the case. And now they have to respond to a court of law in America about the complaint presented by Alan Gross and Judy Gross. We also have very serious humanitarian concerns regarding five Cuban families that were doing nothing wrong. They did not try to change the American society or the American government. They didn't want to do anything to force the U.S. authorities to grant free health care or free education for everybody. No, that's your business. We do not interfere into that. They were just trying to save lives, to protect lives by penetrating the terrorist groups in Miami. That was very clearly demonstrate in the indictment that the prosecutors presented against them. And we think that the U.S. should take its own responsibilities. They are responsible for the action that Mr. Gross made, and it is not me who is saying that. It is Mr. Gross himself who is saying that on November the 16th, last Friday. And the U.S. should also be accountable for what they did in promoting that press campaign in Miami, making it impossible for have a fair trial to the five, and also for having them sentences sent to life terms that were defined by the Court of Appeals as unjust, unfair. That's why they, because they didn't, in, were not involved in any actual espionage. And as I told you before, they recognized that they couldn't prove the other main accusation. There were two important allegations against them. The so-called conspiracy to commit espionage, which according to the Court of Appeals didn't exist because nothing of espionage, nothing affecting national security was involved, and that was a determination by a Court of Appeals, and nothing could be proven against a supposed or an alleged role of Gerardo in the unfortunate event that happened with the small planes. And they have been more than 14 years in jail, separated from their families. Gerardo's mother died, and he couldn't see her before because he died after a long illness. He cannot receive the visit of his wife. There are a number of gross violations of fundamental family and human rights involved in this case. And the U.S. has to assume its responsibility on both cases, on having these five individuals deprived unjustly of their freedom, and to have an American citizen duly condemned in a fair trial in Cuba for doing something that he himself recognized was were activities on behalf of the United States government.
That's the voice of Ricardo Alarcón, president of the National Assembly in Cuba. We're also joined by attorney Martin Garbus for the Cuban Five and Gloria LaRiva, coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips, Project Censored Show. Today's topic, again, U.S.-Cuba relations and the Cuban Five. Let's turn our attention now. The United States has long attempted to reverse the Castro revolution in Cuba, and for a very, very long time has had an economic embargo against the U.S., and recently in the United Nations, a vote of 188-3, I believe, the world voted that these are wrong, these should be ended. So we wanted to turn our attention to some of these international issues. And again, we just had an election here in the United States, or the re-election of Democrat Barack Obama. Let's turn this over to the guests. What do you see? Is anything going to be changing? What is the Obama continuing policy here, even despite the UN vote? Gloria?
Well, I think that anybody in the U.S. with a reasonable sense of justice who hears about, the Cuban Five case or about the blockade and the measures that are really not known to the American public, what the Obama administration has continued, which is more aggression that is perhaps more covert, the financing of small counter-revolutionary groups inside Cuba to try to destabilize the Alan Gross situation, and so much else. People ask, why is this? And why do we have trade with China or Vietnam? And it's simply because I think that Cuba's example to the world, to Latin America, and the alliance that is growing with the ALBA nations of Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and which has been was spearheaded by Cuba and Venezuela, it is a means of resisting neoliberalism, free market, opening up their countries to exploitation, and that is what the U.S. is vehemently against. So the Obama administration's policies are not as open, but they are for the same means of trying to destroy the Cuban revolution. Cuba's sovereignty to decide how they will, run their country, how their economy will be, and so on. And There's an interesting example under the Obama administration about 2 years ago. If you remember, there were Russians, people from Russia who had lived in the U.S. for years as undercover agents. They were arrested. They faced basically the same charge, even maybe heavier charges, than the Cuban Five, but they were sent home in 2 weeks. And I think that's an example of how the U.S., tactics and strategy against Cuba is virulently hostile. And I'd like to recommend two sources of information. The Alan Grove situation, which has been multiplied by many other attempts to subvert inside Cuba with funding of millions of dollars. There is a website called cubadebate.cu. And cubadebate.cu has videos of some of these plots that have been uncovered by the Cubans. And it's just to see that sort of thing would open people's eyes in America to the need to demand an end to the blockade, to demand the right to have solidarity. And you look at the people in New Jersey, New York, and the Eastern Coast who are still suffering from the lack of electricity, the lack of food, their homes destroyed. And the same thing happened in Cuba. But for the right to trade, to share solidarity, to help each other in the reconstruction would be such a huge step forward for our two peoples. But we're denied that. And Project Censored, Pacifica Station, which has been the most consistent in exposing these crimes against the people of Cuba and ourselves, is vital.
Ricardo Alacon, how has the embargo impacted Cuba? And what would change economically and culturally if that was lifted?
Well, the impact of the embargo is overwhelming and affected everybody down here. More than 70% of the Cuban population was born and had lived their entire life under the embargo. We have managed to survive and to resist it by solidarity, by the common effort of everybody, and with the solidarity of other countries also at certain moments. But our foreign minister, during his speech in November at the UN General Assembly, gave some specific examples of children that are affected, because we have a pretty good health care system, which is free. But if you have a specific disease, a heart problem, especially for children, you need some specific equipment that are only American produced, and then we cannot have access to that. That makes people suffer. That is going on and happening, affecting practically everybody's life. Someday the embargo will be lifted, will disappear, and then the quality of life of everybody will improve. And also we could have a normal communication with our neighbors in the north, and as was before, as has been for many, many years, and that would be in our benefit, of course, but I would submit that also in the benefit of American people. The Americans have also the right to those Americans who love ballet, for example. They should have been able to come last week to the International Ballet Festival in Havana, which is attended by people from all over the world, and there are many other examples. It's a small country. We are not many, just 11 million people, but that we may contribute something to the Americans also, and that's a right for your people to have access to. Anyway, we have learned something that perhaps no other people in the world has had to learn, which is how to survive and resist and develop yourself under the very hard conditions of a total embargo by the main economy on earth, the main economy that happens to be your closest neighbor, and to try to reorient redirect your economy, to have a faraway partners, and to invent and develop alternatives to the lack of resources coming from the U.S. was quite an experience that, in a way, had made us stronger and more capable to face difficulties in life. But certainly is the most important factor in our life, and that has affected everybody in this island without exception.
Thank you very much. We've just got a couple minutes left. I want to return back to Martin Garbus. Martin, short of a political decision, which may be the only way, the Cuban Five ultimately, because of the delays in the court, what are the prospects now? If you're going back to the same judge, and then what happens? You're going to pursue this legally. We believe in justice. It sounds like justice would be served for releasing these men. What prospects do you see?
Before I answer that, let me make one other point. This ties into something that President Alarcón was talking about. The Cubans have allowed the family of Rose to visit him. At the same time, what the Americans have done to the Cuban Five is that has punished them with solitary confinement for years on end, and denied the defendants a chance to see their family. So the disparate treatment between the two countries is absolutely startling. I think that with respect to the case itself, we are entitled to a hearing. A hearing will be held. You have a judge who has a predisposition to upholding the conviction. It's one of the jewels in her crown. I think that in any case in the United States, in any place, this case would be immediately reversed. Whether the facts are so clear that even this judge will feel that she has to accept them is something we're going to have to wait and see. It's easy to say that this judge's biases and predispositions go directly counter to the position we're urging. On the other hand, the facts are so astonishingly overwhelming and unprecedented that it may happen. All I can say is there's never been a case like this, where the government has spent so much money with so many people over so long a period of time to intimidate a jury.
Thank you, Martin. We're looking forward to seeing how this case evolves. A week ago, you filed petitions on that. Gloria Riva, you've been here working on this for years, and we certainly appreciate and want to stay in close touch with you. Ricardo, it has been wonderful to hear your voice again and to have you on the air in Northern California and around all over the country with this interview. We sincerely appreciate it, and we hope that we'll be able to just openly take a ferry over to Cuba someday.
No, I want to thank you very much. It was really a pleasure for me, and I would like to say hello to Martin and Gloria and to all your listeners that I know are many around your country. Thank you very much.
Thanks again so much for joining us this morning. Also, if you would like more information to read about the Five and journalists, you can go to Free the Five. That's all spelled out, freethefive.org. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show in the Morning Mix. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks today go to Karen Wald for some of the research behind today's show, and also to Veronica Faison, who is on the controls. So many thanks. Also like to remind you that you are tuned to KPFA 94.1 FM, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.